Thank you so much for sending your questions. We're going to do our best to get to as many of the questions as we possibly can. If we don't get to your question, I do have all your questions, and I'm going to do my best to either talk to Dr. Rodseth or to do some research so I can at least point you in the right direction of where you can maybe find some more answers to those questions. So we're not going to let any of your questions go to waste. So sorry if we don't get your question. So we have three groups of questions we'd like to talk to you about. The first group of questions have to do with suffering and some of the specifics of that. Others have to do with science versus God and faith. And the third group have to do with the origin of God and the origin of life. So we're going to start off with some of the suffering questions. So I'm going to start off with a fairly specific one because you have covered a lot of the general topics well. And this question is, let me just pull it up here. If God is good, why are babies born with deformities? So I know that's quite a specific one, but I think some of the stuff you talked about might have led into that a bit.
Maybe just before I just want to say that if you listen to the questions that are going to be asked, you probably have asked a question like that in your own heart. And if you're sitting with a question of any nature like this, you need to talk about it. You need to find a forum, a church, or a space, or people that you can talk about it. Talk about it safely and not feel like you're being attacked by it. If your kids are 13, 14, 15, they are asking these questions. And you're doing a disservice to them if you're not dealing with these questions and discussing it. If you try to bury your questions, they come back a few years later. And you're an intelligent people. You've got these questions. You need to deal with it. Okay, so the question is, how can God be good if we are born with defects? If you have children that are born with defects. And the same argument can be made, what about children that get cancer? So I've talked about suffering in the world and the fact that a lot of the suffering is caused by the decisions that we make. Children are born with fetal alcohol syndrome as a consequence of the decisions that their parents make. And children are born with addiction problems because of some of the decisions that their parents make. So they're taking cocaine or drugs and from that side. Then the second thing that we believe as Christians is that the world is broken. It's not the way it's supposed to be. I mean, we're always hankering after that perfect place, that perfect home, that perfect something. And we believe that that is how God made it. We made it perfect. But that the reality that we live in has been damaged, has been fractured because of the sin that's in the world. And as a result of that sin, there are consequences in it. And part of that is to live in a world where there are genetic deformities, where there are genetic abnormalities. The question, though, presumes a thing. It says that to live a good life, I must be normal. To live a good life, I must have four limbs, and I must not have any questions. I must have no deficits. It assumes that goodness of life or fullness of life is associated with wholeness of body. And inherent to that is that I somehow have this right or this need that life is about being comfortable and life is about living and having happiness. And the argument that I have made is that, yes, that is a big component of life, but that is not the purpose of life. From a Christian viewpoint, we believe that we were created in God's image to have a relationship with Him and have a relationship with one another. And that this world has been damaged as a result of it. And this whole process that we go through is one of rebuilding that relationship with Christ and with God. So my argument for that is that God can be good. It doesn't necessarily mean that as I've argued, that the whole world needs to be perfect. In fact, the reason it's not perfect is because we know why it's not perfect. It's because the actions that we've taken, and it damaged the world significantly in this way. And we all know the world is broken. Every religion, every faith, everything says the question, why is the world broken? What is broken with the world? And every religion, every faith tries to answer, what do we do to fix this world? For atheists, we need just more education, because the more educated we are, the better we'll be able to do this. In Buddhism, it's about reaching a state of not caring and giving up on it. In Hinduism, it's about moving through the cycles of suffering so that you can transcend. So everybody's got an answer to it, but we all know that it's broken.
Thanks for that answer. And I guess this one sort of carries on. This is the sort of last suffering one we're going to hit. Is how do you deal with environmental suffering? So we've talked a lot about personal suffering, a lot about, you know, suffering that's the result of a parent's decisions or our own decisions or that sort of thing. But sort of things which are not caused by humans or human error directly. So things like tsunamis, hurricanes, flash floods. How do we deal with environmental suffering from that point of view?
Okay, so again, answering from Christian perspective, the first thing to say is that for the world to be the way it is, you need to have stuff like weather and earthquakes. Now, it sounds a bit stupid, but if you speak to somebody that's into sort of geology, the plate tectonics that we have and the way that the plates move with one another creates the environment, creates the stability that we have in our environment on our earth. You get nutrient recycling, you get mineral recycling. It provides the stability, but to have those plate tectonics means that you have to have earthquakes. You have to have this type of function. To have weather that we have, to have the degree of stability that we have, you will, as a consequence of that, have extreme weather. And if you think the weather on Earth is extreme, you look at something like Jupiter, where, you know, the weather on that is just incredible. Jupiter's red spot is about twice as big as what Earth is. It's just a raging gas storm, unlivable. So certain things have to be the way they are for our environment to work. The second argument that I would make, again, is that people sometimes make really stupid decisions. So California is built on the St. Andreas Fault, which breaks, you know, once every 100, 150 years. And we choose to build there. Often in South Africa and Mozambique, we build along floodplains. And then every 10 years have massive flood events. So we make decisions sometimes that put us in that harm's way. And the third thing is that I believe that God can use these type of events to break into our happy little worlds. So if you look at a country where you've got money and food and time, Australia, New Zealand, wherever, you know, it's just so comfortable. You live in a little bubble where nothing touches you. And all of a sudden there's an earthquake in Christchurch. And the second that happens, people start asking, how is this be? Where is God? What is going on? And all of a sudden it breaks into this little comfortable world that you've built. It draws people together. All of a sudden we're, you know, bringing food to people, and suffering breaks into our fake world. It exposes us to the reality. And again, I'm going to argue that that is what life is about. It's not about having your TV and your nice house. It's actually about engaging with the people around you and dealing with this major question. So there's not one little, you know, clean little package to put together like that. But again, I just want to say that the reason I have this viewpoint is in maths, you know, you start from first principles, 1 + 1 = 2, and then like 10 years later you've built an atomic bomb. So for me, these things start off with the existence of God and the resurrection. These things are true, and then on top of that, that's a foundation. And the answers that I'm giving you are built on the presupposition that these things are true. So they are Christian arguments, which I believe are rational and robust. The foundation and the reason that I'm making these statements is built on this foundational truth.
Okay, great. So that kind of leads us into, we've talked a bit about science in there, so I feel like that's a good segue to sort of lead into the discussion of science and God. Now, a lot of these questions are fairly general, but I'm just going to go through, if we can ask you some of these things. A lot of people say that science and Christianity do not mix because of theories like evolution and the Big Bang. So obviously, this is a very broad perspective to take. And another question was, can science prove that there is a God? So if we can sort of first talk about, you know, is there a way of taking generally accepted scientific theories like evolution and the Big Bang theory as a Christian, and can we use Christianity to explain those theories? Or do those theories disprove the existence of God?
Okay, so I believe that if something's not true, you shouldn't be following it, right? I also believe that if you get reality wrong, you're going to get seriously hurt. So if you think that the traffic flows from left to right, and you go over to France, and you step, look left, step right, and you walk into a bus, you're going to get hurt. If you think that you can fly and you jump off a building, you're going to get hurt. So if you get reality wrong, you get seriously hurt. In medicine, that's true. When we don't understand what's really going on, and we give medications to people, we cause serious harm, and it's been done before. So I believe that the claims that we make about God in the church must fit with what we see outside the church in reality. If they don't fit, then one of these things is wrong. So this, if we look at God and his creation through the spiritual lens, it needs to fit in with what we see outside it in the science world. You can't be a Christian in church and walk outside the door and all of a sudden, like, you know, it doesn't count anymore. And that was my big claim, my big issue is, can I be a leading researcher that takes my science seriously and still make the claim that I'm a Christian? Do I really, really, really believe that a man that lived 2,000 years ago in Palestine, in Jerusalem, died, and then he rose from the dead? Now I need to go to Toronto University and tell the guys at my cardiology conference that I'm a Christian because this dead man rose. So if I'm going to say those words and retain any credibility, I actually need to believe it. And that was my challenge. So from a resurrection argument, I've given, I hope everybody's got a copy of that book. It's a very nice, short, 60-page book that makes a factual, historical argument for the resurrection. But I looked at Christianity through the sciences lens. And my conclusion is that it shows the model of the creation of the world around us from a scientific perspective fits the best. It was best explained through the Christian worldview, the way that Christians think the world is. And they don't conflict with one another. I think that atheism has got a much greater conflict with the science as we see it as opposed to Christianity. Just as an example, physics and the most clear understanding of how cosmology, how this universe came into being, is that the universe started as what is called a singularity. All time, all space, all matter, everything that we know, if you start to run the universe backwards, comes down to a point where there was nothing. And that nothing is nothing, no time, no space. Now, it's difficult for us to comprehend it, so we normally think of a big empty room, and then like a little pea in the middle of it. But all the room, all the time, everything comes to that point, right? So there was nothing, and then all of a sudden, there is everything. So what caused this singularity to come into being? So whatever called the singularity to come into being can't be matter, because there is no matter. It can't have space. It can't have time. So it's outside space, outside time, is immaterial. It must be incredibly powerful to be able to generate something like this. So you've got an entity that is outside time, outside space, incredibly powerful. And I would also argue that this entity must be able to make a decision. So if I take this piece of paper and I drop it like this, and I ask you, why did it drop? You say, well, an electrical impulse went down my hand, I opened up the muscles in my hand, gravity took over and it fell to the ground. So it's a mechanistic cause. But one of the other reasons that I dropped it is because I decided to drop it. There's two explanations for it. So what do you do if there is no time, no space, no matter, there is no mechanistic cause? The only thing that you have got to cause something is mind, to choose. So now physics suggests that the cause of the universe is timeless, spaceless, immaterial, outside, incredibly powerful, and can make a decision. It's got agent causality. What is that? What is that definition? That's the definition of God. So that's called the cosmological argument. So physics, the most clear sort of inference is fits in solidly with Christianity, and God said that there is a God, and the God is separate from his creation. And the main religions that say that God is not his creation or in his creation, but separate from his creation, are Christianity, Islam, Judaism. And then out of those three, how do you know which ones are true? Well, I think that the resurrection proves that Christianity is true. So that's the design, biological design, the fine-tuning of the universe, these arguments for morality, all of those things are scientific arguments that I believe support the truth of Christianity.
Sure. Well, thanks. That's a very comprehensive answer to that question. I think with regards to the science, I think that covered a lot. So if we can move on from those questions. A few people, so you mentioned other religions, and there's been quite a few questions about other religions. So one example of this is, what do we make of all the old world religions, the polytheistic religions of the Greeks, the Romans, and the indigenous of Africa? What was God their God too? Did they just worship him in a different way?
Okay, so some of these things I can't answer or don't know the full answer to, and I don't know if we've got a really clear answer for a lot of this stuff. From a Christian perspective, and from our most clear understanding, comes from what Paul teaches in the book of Romans about this. And he says that, firstly, he says that every person in all cultures, all times, we all know that there is a God. Like, we all know that there's a God. You just walk outside and you look at the trees and the universe and you know that there's a God. We know it. Some people, then all of us deny that fact. So we all pretend like there isn't a God, and then we live our own way. We make our own rules, and as a result of that rejection, that's why we're stuck. That is the human condition, the problem with that. So all of these religions are people understanding an echo of that, understanding that there is a God, and then creating some type of religion around it. The Old Testament gives us examples of people that weren't Israelites, that weren't part of the chosen nation, that knew God and worshipped him. There's one or two guys that pop up in Scripture that seems to suggest that there were people that were following the true God. How those people are viewed and how they're understood, I think, is something that God leaves up to us, or that he will be looking at. The question that we're dealing with now is this time, it says that, and Paul says that, now that you've come to this time where Christ has come, Jesus Christ becomes the mediator, the person through which we can know God. So are these people following God? I don't know. I would be hesitant to say. Some of them I would say definitely not, because they don't fulfill what I would understand to be the criteria for worshiping God. Some of them would maybe have had a really true desire to meet God, and God might have revealed themselves to them. Luckily, I am not God, and I won't have to deal with that aspect. But I think going forward, and this is some of the difficult argument, the argument that I'm making is that Christianity provides the way to God. Jesus made some crazy, crazy claims. And the one above all is that he is the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one comes to the Father, the God, through him, except through him. And that type of exclusive claim that he makes is crazy to make. I mean, it's ridiculous to make. And the things that he said were ridiculous, to the point that the people killed him for what he was saying. But by raising himself from the dead, he proved that what he was saying is true. As difficult as it is to stomach for us, it is true, and it validates everything that he said. And as a result of that, and the things that he said, and the proofs that he's given to it, I believe that that is true.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes difficult sometimes to answer. There are a few people who are asking questions from the point of view of, you can tell they're answering questions from colleagues at work and friends as well regarding that. Some saying, so is there a way of proving our God of Christianity with science alone? And then there does become a point, from what I'm understanding, where we should be standing on using the Bible in order to say, you know, look, we can use science to show that there's a God, but we also are going to be using the philosophy that we get from God's word as well to sort of show why we believe that our God is the one and true God. Is that fair to say, or how would you sort of respond
to that? Okay, so let me start by saying there are very few things that we can prove, like solidly. Like mathematics deals with individual numbers, and I can show you that 1 + 1 = 2. Like there's no doubt about it. It just is. 1 + 1 = 2. And then you get a little bit of physics, and physics is a lot harder, and it's a lot more clear. It's much easier to study. You know, it's physical stuff, engineering. They're hard things. You can write formulas. You can describe it. You move into math, into biology, like my job, things become a little bit murky. You know, you've got to do big studies, and it's difficult to know exactly. You move into psychology, humanities, it becomes harder and harder to prove this stuff. So when I say, can I prove that God exists, I can't give you a mathematical formula to prove God. But I can make an argument that I think is compelling, robust, reasonable, and like I said, answers this from a scientific, a morality, a historical viewpoint. So I can argue for the existence of God. And I will argue that God has certain characteristics that are consistent from the world we see us around us with what we would term the Christian God. So that's my first point. There is a God. And then the second thing is comes down to this person, Jesus Christ. And you know, some people have said to me, you make a big deal of this Jesus. It's what the core of Christianity is. Christianity is a follower of Christ. If this Christianity, if Jesus did not rise from the dead, you're wasting your time with Christianity. Christianity is the only religion that says, test me. If you want to be, know Buddhism is true, you need to go through the whole process, fivefold path, the whole thing. At the end, maybe you know. Christianity says, test me. If Jesus did not rise from the dead, junk it. Go and play soccer on the Sunday. It says, test me. And I believe that we can test the truth of Christianity by not even looking at the Bible as an inspired book. This thing that I've handed out to you makes an argument for the truth of Christianity. And if that is true, and I believe it is, then the things that Jesus said become true. And so we've built a platform. And then some things are theological in nature. We answer those questions or those challenges from the framework of saying, well, I believe that what the Bible says is true because I believe Jesus Christ. And I believe Jesus Christ because of what he did. And he proved it to me. He showed it to me. And then on top of that, you start to your own experience. But I have issues sometimes with people going just down the experience route. So some of these things are theological truths that I take, inverted commas, on faith. Because I don't know what they mean, and I only have what God has showed us. But the reason I believe this is not just blind. I've gone through a process and I've said, well, he has shown himself to made these claims, and he's backed it up. And that, for me, is the argument. If you look at what the disciples did in the book of Acts, is they all go in with the arguments of Jesus Christ and the resurrection. Like they're going around telling people that this guy died and rose from the dead. And some of the people say to him, you're crazy. Some of them, well, that's a bit interesting. And some people actually believe it. So that's how I would build, that's how I approach this argument.
A lot of the time, people, especially who have a more atheistic worldview, talk about science versus faith.
Yeah.
When people make statements like that, I think we should be ready to potentially take them up on that. How would you recommend going about that?
So some people are inclined, everybody's different. And for some people, a meeting like this is enough. Like you hear enough of the stuff, you're happy with what you hear, what you read, and you say, well, cool, I've answered some questions, off it goes. Some of you, like me, are cursed with this thing about thinking too much. And so my interest is biology. One of the big concerns I had with Christianity was this whole evolution thing. So what I did is I tried to seriously deal with the question, is evolution true, and how do I reconcile it with what I believe? Because Genesis 1 starts, the first book of the Bible says that God created. If the first chapter is wrong, how can I believe the rest of this thing? How do I reconcile it? So my calling as a medical doctor, part of that is to get stuck into it and understand it and satisfy myself. And if I can satisfy myself that it's true, then I can satisfy you. Some one of you is a psychology student, third year. She's going to have a calling to try and deal with these type of questions and sort it out for herself, getting stuck into it, delving into it. And the resources are overwhelming. I think a little book like I've given you now, every person in the church should read it and understand it or have a basic argument for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This is a book that says God's not dead. It's not the movie. It's much better than a movie. And it makes five simple arguments for the truth of Christianity. And I think every high school student and first year, second year student should read this as a foundational book. And you're a rational, intelligent person when you get a challenge about, you know, the science argument. So answer it, because you've worried about that yourself. And it's a myth that that science and religion are at war. At their very deepest core, there's a deep synergy between Christianity and religion, religion and science. We have a God that is mind, that has imbued the universe with structure. In a random, unstructured universe, you don't expect structure. They speak of mathematics as having an unreasonable capacity to explain the universe. Why is mathematics so embedded in the very structure of the universe? Why should that be like that? Why should the universe be so incredibly fine-tuned? It's not what you would expect out of an evolutionary process of random processes. Why are we able to identify truth? True truth. Because evolution doesn't select for truth. Evolution selects for survivability. So when you start to push these things, if you're doing a psychology, philosophy studies, those are the type of questions that you need to be asking. And I think the thing that Christianity sells itself short on is there's a massive tradition of us being able to do that. And do it. There are massive academics, great, great minds through time that have been dealt with these things, that have struggled with them, that have got really robust, deep answers. And we've sort of retreated from it. So we hide in the church because you're scared to go out there. Don't let your kids think too many questions, ask too many questions, because it's dangerous. And then we hide over here. And we got good answers. So we need to do some work, pick up a book, do some reading, and don't get stuck in.
There were a few questions about where can we get evidence for the resurrection, and I think your question was answered before you even asked it by the book that's in your hand. So also,
there's one or two
also, yeah.
Good, Rabbi Zacharias Ministries is a really good website, and there's a website called bebelieving.org, standtoreason.org is also. So there's an overwhelming flood of ministries available that you can use, that you can study. Just if you do get into this, you need to do this with a sense of humility. Particularly if you're intellectual, you tend, like myself, tend to become quite arrogant in the things that you think. And the more you know, the more arrogant you become. But you want to understand that we're instructed to do this with humility and with respect. So God allows non-Christians to choose not to follow Him. So God has given us free will that you can choose not to follow God, as crazy as that sounds. So you as a Christian need to respect somebody else's right to choose differently and to engage with them with respect, to treat them with a dissenting view and dissenting opinion with respect, to recognize the humanity and the integrity of that person, and to really listen to what people are saying. And we need to be trained and we need to learn how to do that.
All right. Are you guys okay to go for another 10 minutes? Is that all right? Because there are a few more good questions that have cropped up even as we're talking. If it's all right, it would be nice to, well, we've got you to hit a few of them. There are a few questions regarding can a good God send people to hell? Some just stated specifically like that. Others saying, would a child born with cancer or AIDS go to heaven or hell before being born again as a Christian? Okay. Could you talk a little bit around that for us as well?
Okay, so God is a God of love. And the big concern is, how dare he send everybody to hell? How can a good God send good people to hell? Right? So the first thing too that I say when I talk about this is, you know, when we talk about hell, we have this concept of a place burning with fire, you know, with all these people that God has thrown into it. And when we talk about heaven, it's up in the sky, floating on the clouds. You know, that's the concept. The Christian understanding of heaven and hell is God is the most perfect, complete fullness, goodness, and to be with God is to be in heaven. To be in a relationship with the one that created you, that loves you, that knows you in its entirety, in his complexity, in his wonder, that is heaven, to be with God. Wherever that place is, in that relationship, that is God. To be fully separated from that God is to be in hell. Now, you know when you have a fight with your wife or your boyfriend or whoever, or your brother or sister, you can't stand to be in the same room with one another. You're riding in the car and there's this tension between you. Now, when God creates you, you have the opportunity to choose to love him and to be with him, but you have the opportunity to be separate from him. If heaven is being with God, and you choose not to follow this God, surely that would be totally wrong for him to force you to be with him. Many people think that you choose not to be with God, and God grants you in craziness your wish is to be fully separated from him. So it's not that God is throwing you into hell. It's that an atheist that has spent his entire life denying the existence of God, that if you look at Richard Dawkins, hates God, the whole concept of God, it would be wrong for him to be in heaven in this relationship with God because he hates him, he doesn't want him. So God grants him the wish to be fully separated from him. The implication of that is devastating, I think, because God is the source and the font of life, and to have all goodness and all God's grace and all his mercy removed from you, as a result, I think that is hell. So C.S. Lewis says that hell's door is locked on the inside. You've got a key. You're choosing not to be in this relationship. You know that there is a God. You choose to live your own way, and the consequence of that is that you get what you want, which is quite scary. And that's pretty clear, because constantly through Scripture it says, choose today. Would you want to live here or do you want to live here? Make your decision, and the decisions that you make count. And that is in the nature of us as humans. God has created us with the ability to choose, and the choice really, really has a consequence. So that's what I would say.
No, thanks for that. Would you, with regards to children who are born, the questions that came up about that, children who are born and die before they, you could argue before they have free will, what would you say to someone who says, ask you that question, like would those children go to hell or to heaven, or is there a clear answer?
So I don't think there's a very clear biblical answer. Biblically, it's clear that God knows us as we've been created, that he knows us before you knew me, as I was knit together in my mother's womb, you knew me. David writes that in one of the Psalms. So God knows us from the time of our conception and even before that. So my belief and my understanding is that before you have the ability to make this choice, this decision, if you died before that, that God, you would come to be with God. But that's just my impression of it. I'm open for a discussion. I think it's interesting. I don't think it's, you know, one of these hills to die on type of thing. It's, you know.
All right, we're going to answer one more question, which is quite different to all the others. But I think just because you talked a little bit about you went through a time of depression, and I think there are a lot of questions that people have, and I think the church has in many ways responded poorly to the question of depression and being a Christian. There was a question of how do you deal with depression as a Christian? It is a very short question, but I know that it sometimes can come from something which has to do with potentially people being told that they have not got enough faith. That maybe is why they are struggling with depression, or that depression is a result of sin in their life. that they don't need medication. I was wondering if you wouldn't, you know, from your personal experience, if you don't mind sharing a little bit, as a doctor and as someone who has experienced being diagnosed with depression as a Christian, how would you respond to that?
So the first thing I'd say is that humans are quite complex things. We are, the medical term is multifactorial. There are a lot of things that play in that have a big influence on us. Without a doubt, where you are spiritually, and if there's sin in your life, if you are lying and cheating and covering stuff up, it has an impact on you. It also has an impact on you physically. But without a doubt, there is a big biological component to it. In our family, on my father's side, there is a strong history of depression. So my grandmother's side and one of my uncles as well. My brother has also struggled with it. So there is a biological component to it that is like, it just is there. So when I've struggled with depression, it's been quite a progressive thing, and I don't actually notice it. So at once, in times I've tried to come off my medication, and after about 2 weeks, my wife looks at me and says to me, "You're not taking your medicine anymore." And so what happens is that I start becoming slightly withdrawn, and I don't laugh as much, and I don't notice it at all. You know, I don't engage with the kids, and it's subtle. I don't pick it up, and what's happening is that I'm sort of sliding into this little bit of a hole that the people around me can see. And at the moment, I'm a follower of Christ. I don't have any major unconfessed sins in my life. You know, I believe that it's a biological component of it. So I think you need to take depression seriously, because it is a debilitating thing and it can have a profound impact on your life. I think the church needs to take it seriously as well and not just push it down into one thing. Yes, there are people that are struggling. Like when in my process, I was going through huge psychological, spiritual issues. I was struggling with having changed careers, working in a different place. There was a lot of stuff there. But there's undoubtedly a biological predisposition to it. I think taking medication has been, for me, it's been a life changer. Like, I don't know if I probably would have committed suicide if I had continued down this path. And some people become debilitated to the point where they can't engage at all. And in some ways, you want to get over that stigma. You know, I call it my crazy pills, but, you know, without them, I can't function. Well, I can function, but the rest of my family can't engage with me when I do that. So there's a multiple components to it. There's definitely a biological component to it, and that can then be accentuated by, you know, you don't eat well, you don't exercise well, your psychological life and your spiritual life is in a mess. It's going to make it so much worse. So I can deal with it a whole lot better now, but it's part of what I have. I've also got hypertension, high blood pressure, you know, so I take medication for that. I've got arthritis that's developed recently, take medication for that. Losing my hair.
Hair transplant?
Yeah. Sometimes you just got to face it, eh?
Yeah, definitely. Dr. Rosier, thank you so much for being willing to answer the intellectual questions and also for opening up personally to us as well. We really appreciate that.